Welcome to a podcast of The Mike Novak Show. You can listen to Mike live Sunday mornings from 9 to 11 Central on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Companies don't have to tell you everything that's in their products, but SC Johnson isn't just a company. We're a family. And like every good family, we keep our secrets. It's for your own good. That's why we're committed to keeping our fragrance ingredients top secret. We decide what you need to know. And trust us, you don't need to know about the toxic chemicals that make up the scents that you love. So with products like Glade Air Freshener, you actually have no idea what you're bringing into your home. Especially when it comes to scents like lavender and vanilla and clean linen. And that's the way we like it. Do we go beyond the industry standard? Not really. But we do have a double standard. We believe our European customers are smarter, which is why we list some fragrance ingredients on labels, so that Europeans, even the French, can make their own choice. But we don't do that here in the good old US of A, because we know that Americans, like you, trust family companies, like us, to decide what you really need to know. Secret toxic chemicals, from the SC Johnson family to yours.
Live from the beautiful Showcase Studios on North Milwaukee Avenue in Chicago, in between Angie's Deli and Lido Banquets, and just a pierogi's throw away from the Polish capital of the Western Hemisphere. It's The Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast deep green gardening and environment program. Heard every Sunday right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. True currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in the main.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, a Davey company. Their business is people and their love for trees. And by Recycled Granite, featuring eco-friendly split stone veneers and handmade products by individuals with disabilities. Go to recycledgranite.com. And by Birchold's Floral Gift and Garden Center. Get green, let's get growing. He's so green, he takes his life in his hands every time he walks across an intersection. Here he is, Mike Novak.
One more time.
Well, that was slightly a rough beginning. It's not exactly what I had in mind, but hey, you know. We're up and going now. Everything's cool. I'm sorry. What was that, darling?
That's good enough for a rainy Sunday morning.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Good enough for me.
And what a strange phenomenon we have out there. Rain. I haven't seen that in a while.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, what I meant to do as I was doing the show prep this morning is to check the radar just to see. Are we going to get a spritz here, which is what we have normally had in the last 2 months? Or is this going to be a real rain? I'm kind of hoping for a real rain.
Me too.
Wouldn't that be nice?
My garden needs it.
Isn't that weird? I mean, we started out this year, and meteorologist Rick DeMaio and I have chatted about this time and time again this year. How strange. I heard a term for the first time this week that I had never heard before, which is flash drought. Have you ever heard that phrase?
No.
I'm going to ask. I know. It seems odd. Flash drought, meaning a drought that happens very suddenly, meaning that, you know, not something has been building for years, but something that happens over a couple of months. So I heard that parts of the area are in a flash drought. Now, that was the first time I had ever heard that phrase. I'm going to ask Rick DeMaio about that today.
I swear it happens in my own yard. Like, I know it rained on Wednesday at my place.
A little bit.
I
think it was Thursday.
Hydrangeas were still
droopy?
Yeah. And I was like, I thought it just rained.
hydrangeas like water. They like their water. You know that. Welcome to the show, folks. I'm looking forward to this. This is a program that I think is going to be informative and entertaining. In the first hour, we're going to discuss something that I've been meaning to discuss for a long, long time and that lots of people are discussing already, and that is GMOs and, in particular, GMO labeling. The debate has come to Illinois, and I was surprised a little bit. Sometimes these things go under the radar. I put that on Facebook, that it seemed like it was kind of under the radar. The bill... Senate Bill 1666 was proposed in February of this year, and you didn't hear a lot about that. And then suddenly now we have testimony, and we're going to have a debate, a hearing this Tuesday, September 17th, at the Blandick Building, 160 North LaSalle, in room 600, and it's going to be about the SB 1666, the Genetically Engineered Food Labeling Act for Illinois. And this has been happening in other parts of the country, and now it's come to Illinois, and we're going to talk in the first hour about GMOs and GMO labeling. Phone calls are welcome, 773-763-9278. We have Jessica Fuyan in the studio, who's with Food and Water Watch. We have... Do we use the middle initial or the first initial to A. Brian? Is it A. Brian Endress or is it just Brian Endress?
It's just Brian.
Okay. You've got A. The and every now and then if I go A, that's
respond.
That's you. Megan Klein, who's with the Chicago Food Policy Advisory Council, and she will be here with us in a second. Rick DeMille Weather, of course, at 9:45. And then in the second hour, really cool. I'm happy to have Michelle Hoffman is an educator at a number of places in Chicago, including the School of the Art Institute and Columbia. And where else is she from? She's just in a number of places. And she has is putting together a documentary film called Microcosm. And she's going to talk about that. And it's about the oceans and the little stuff in the oceans and how little stuff means big stuff. It sounds fascinating. And she's going to be here at 10 o'clock. And then our buddy, Dan Costa, bonsai guy, will be here towards the end of the show to talk about a show at the Morton Arboretum, the Prairie State Bonsai Society. See, Dan's mission in life is to convince everybody they need to become obsessed by bonsai. And apparently when people start to do it, they become obsessed by bonsai. So that's his job. And he wants you to come out and see the show next weekend, September 21st and 22nd, and he'll be here to talk about that. So let's start. Let's get right to the GMO issue. And I want to start, Jessica, with you because you've kind of been Food and Water Watch has been behind the efforts to get labeling on GMOs in Illinois. Tell me about the bill that was proposed. I understand that you also, Food and Water Watch, played a part in crafting the language for that.
That's right. So we actually began working on the labeling campaign in a number of states here in the U.S. and worked really heavily on the Prop 37 campaign that was so popular in California.
But it didn't pass. How popular could it have been?
It was actually very close. I believe that they only lost by about 2%.
Yeah, it was a close vote.
Fantastic run. And we were outspent 10-1 by the biotech industry.
Yeah, about $14 million came in for the opposing side.
Oh, about 40. Over $40 million.
Wait a second. I'm sorry. You're right.
Were
yes,
spent
40.
By the opposing side. And so we actually thought the nonprofit organizations and some natural food businesses made a great run. Ballot initiatives are very difficult to win because of spending in the media that needs to occur. And so we thought they did a great job. And here in Illinois, we actually worked with the Center for Food Safety out of Washington, D.C. on bill language that was later introduced by Senator Dave Kaler of Peoria. And it is a bill that would require foods containing more than 1% genetically engineered ingredients to have a label indicating as such. Yeah, and we're really excited about all of the support we've gotten in the legislature and the incredible groundswell of support that's come from the grassroots.
Have you done polling on this now? Do you have any sense of where you are with support in Illinois?
Here in Illinois, we don't have any statistics, but there have been studies in the last few years that show over 90% of people are in favor of genetically engineered food labeling. And so we're very confident that those statistics hold true in Illinois. And we've seen thousands of people come out to support this bill. So we're very confident.
And also in the room, I have Brian Endres, who's Associate Professor of Agricultural Law at the University of Illinois. And welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I'm happy to have you here. Now, you've already testified about this bill, and you did that on June 20th of this year. Care to give me a summary? I've got the testimony right here in my hot little hands. Give me an idea of your point of view on this.
Sure. I sort of in the testimony took it from a legal perspective and went through some of the legal challenges that have been brought against mandatory labeling of biotech foods, and laid out a course where, you know, these things will pass constitutional muster. I mean, I think that there's enough significant differences between biotech and non-biotech food that consumers, in essence, have a legitimate claim that they have a right to know.
Wait, so you've actually kind of skipped a step here, which
sure.
is to say that is going to be the attack used by the opponents of this bill, to say that it's not constitutional.
That's one of the attacks. And being a law professor, that's sort of where I, you know, entered the debate, is some of these constitutional issues that you basically have your compelling speech. It's a First Amendment claim by the biotech companies that are saying you shouldn't be forcing us to label something. And that's
so we don't have to say First Amendment works the opposite way, is what you're saying, too. It's not just the right to say something. It's the right to say nothing.
Absolutely.
I thought that was Fifth Amendment.
Oh, that's when you're in the criminal context, and I don't think we want to criminalize
okay.
this. We just want to label it.
All right. But is that a strong argument?
I think it has been a strong argument.
Okay, and by that I mean, okay, in the past, yes, the
sure.
argument that, no, we don't have to say anything.
Absolutely. It's been raised throughout time, whether it's cigarette warning labels or even in the biotech food context, RBST milk in Vermont. There was a whole series of litigation that went on that actually struck down a Vermont law that would have required RBST labels on milk products.
Mm-hmm.
And
is that where it stands now?
That's where it stands now. Yes.
See, I think most of us, I think us average Joes out in the street, think it should be the other way around, which is to say we are the public. We have a right to know. You don't have a right to obfuscate and lie. You need to be up front with what you have. Where's the right of the public in all of this?
Yeah, what's interesting in that Vermont case, the name of the case is Amistoy, by the way. And they said that the court, it was a split opinion. It was 2-1 in the Court of Appeals. And they said, well, if the public really demands this, the market will respond, and you'll have companies voluntarily labeling it that it's not from cows treated with RBST. And so that was
– the public doesn't know.
And that's part of the problem.
The public doesn't pay enough attention, okay, which is why groups like Food and Water Watch exist, which is why groups – you know, all of those environmental groups are out there because they are the ones paying attention. All right, and we'll get to Megan in just a second. Hang on, Megan. You go back to the start of the GMOs in our society, which is basically the late 90s, 1996, 1997. That's not that long ago. You know, you're talking about how companies feel they have a right to withhold this information, and yet as it came in, I'm betting that most people didn't know that this stuff was entering their food. There's a promo with Bill Curtis. I interviewed him several months ago, and he said they sneaked it in. And when Bill Curtis says it, and they sneaked it in, and he pronounces every consonant when he says that. but it's true. And then suddenly, it seems to me then 13 years down the road, 16 years down the road, what the companies say is, oh, well, we've always done it like that. So why should we have to let folks know whether GMOs? Because it'll kill our business, which is now well established. But we're only talking 16 years. So, again, I say, where's the protection for the average Joe?
Well, an interesting point that you bring up is that the biotech industry has made the claim that labeling would criminalize their products and then people would no longer buy them. And I mean, to be fair, we're not criminalizing anything. Senator Kaler has made the great point over and over that we started labeling peanut products when allergies became a problem, and we have not vilified or criminalized, you know, the peanut by any stretch of the imagination. Trans fats are another
good point.
Thing that we're labeled.
People need to know because people could have severe reactions to peanut.
Well, and with trans fats, you know, which people don't have severe or allergic reactions to necessarily, we see products with trans fats all the time that people continue to buy. And so if the biotech industry is making claims that, you know, people's knowledge of their products in a food would hurt their sales, then that's just an image problem that they have. And I don't think it's anyone's responsibility but their own to protect their branding and to make those products popular themselves.
You know, you did bring up Senator Kaler, but so is he the chief sponsor of the bill?
That's correct.
David Kaler out of Joliet area. And who else have you been working with on this issue?
We have a lot of great sponsors. We were working with Deb Mell, who, as you know, is now a city council person here in Chicago. And it would be wonderful if we could pass a non-binding resolution through the Chicago City Council urging Chicago legislators to approve this legislation. But we've got some great bill sponsors. John Collerton is a co-sponsor. We've also got Barbara Flynn Curry, a co-sponsor of this bill. We've got a lot of powerful legislators who are in favor of labeling. And we think that as more people become aware not only of this issue, but of the bill, we'll see that continue to rise. And I will say that one of the things that I personally was surprised by was how many of our lawmakers were not aware that GMOs were present in the foods that they're eating. And so
really?
This has also been an educational campaign, I think, for a lot of people we've talked to.
Do you find that as well, Brian?
Yeah, I don't spend as much time dealing directly with the legislature, but I think as a general rule, the public is relatively unaware. I mean, your listeners are on the cutting edge.
Our listeners, yes, you know this station. The people who are listening to this show right now have heard this ad infinitum. All right. Over and over again, they know the GMOs are in there. They know that the state of California had a ballot initiative. They probably know that the state of Washington has a ballot initiative right now that's mm-hmm. going to be voted on in a couple of months. Actually, I saw polls on that, and it's running very high in favor of labeling GMOs. Is that does that break the dam? Does that help unlock the key? If you get one state, does it start to move into other states?
I would say that the combination of states that's come forward, you know, even just introducing genetically engineered food labeling has been a huge help for us here in Illinois. I think that this issue has come to the forefront of the media. I think people are talking about the issue more than they ever have before. And like I was saying before, education is really the key, I think, to the success of this program. So many people become interested in genetically engineered food labeling when they realize for the first time that there are hidden ingredients in the foods that they feed their families.
But there are other kinds of hidden ingredients, too. There it seems to me that's sort of the history of food packaging in America, isn't it?
It certainly is. And here in Illinois, for instance, there was a fabulous campaign to put expiration dates on food. I think most of us would find it shocking to believe that we had to fight for expiration dates.
You know why? Because it will kill the industry if we put labeling, if we put dates, expiration dates. And that's the argument now, is that these people are saying it will kill Oh, I don't know, the whole food industry. People will stop eating food if
so
we put GMO labels. Well, I mean, I am being a little over the top with that, but isn't that, is there any indication that that would actually happen?
No, and we've done so much research, and we also have the European Union to look at. Here we have a combination of countries who have put forth restrictions. They require labeling. In a lot of those countries, you can't even grow genetically engineered food.
Yeah, but the French are involved in that. Aren't they?
Are we anti-French on this show?
No, not on this show.
Oh, no.
I'm just anticipating here.
But the interesting point is that when you look at food prices as a percentage of income in Europe versus in the United States, they're not that much different. And I'm not an economist. I want to make that clear. I'm a lawyer. But I've also studied the European Union's food labeling laws for biotech for over a decade. And there really hasn't been a difference. But what you do is you have consumers that are in control of their food supply as opposed to the agribusiness in control of the food supply. And I think that's an important distinction that we need to start thinking about in the United States. And Illinois tends to be ground zero right now because we have a tremendous food industry in Illinois. We have amazing agricultural production as soon as you get south of Interstate 80. And then we have tremendous food manufacturing here in the Chicago area. So it's, if something can happen here, it's a real signal for the rest of the country.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say that it seems, of all the states, this is one where it would be very tough to get a bill. You're shaking your head no, Jessica. I'm saying because there's a lot of big ag in Illinois.
There is a lot of big ag, but there are also quite a few people. And here in Chicago,
well, there's a lot of people in Chicago. Yeah, I mean, and that's that tension between, you know, Chicago and downstate, mm-hmm. and big ag and big consumerism. All right. By the way, that's Jessica Fuyen from Food and Water Watch. We have Brian Endres, Associate Professor of Agricultural Law at the University of Illinois. I think at this point we should bring in Megan Klein, who is with the Chicago Food Policy Advisory Council. Good morning, Megan.
Good morning, Mike. Thank you for having me on the show.
My pleasure. What have we missed here in this discussion since you've been sitting there listening to us?
Well, actually, I wanted to jump in and talk about, you know, it's amazing that the legislators don't know that there are genetically modified ingredients in most of packaged foods, but it's also amazing that the public is largely unaware. You know, as we said, the people listening to this show are educated on the issue, but we have hundreds of people coming to Chicago Food Policy Advisory Council meetings every month, and they're generally interested in food, and they read up on it, and they're generally aware, and they're not aware of the genetically modified foods and the ingredients in what they eat. And when they learn about it, they are up in arms, and they want to know, and they want to know what they're feeding their families, and they find it absolutely unbelievable that things such as peanuts and everything else is labeled, but they can't, they have no way of knowing when their food has been genetically engineered or not.
The poor little peanut keeps getting vilified here. The Center for Food Safety says that currently up to 85% of U.S. corn, 85% is genetically engineered, 91% of soybeans, 88% of cotton. Cottonseed oil is often used in food products. It has been estimated that upwards of 75% of processed foods on supermarket shelves, from soda to soup, crackers to condiments, contain genetically engineered ingredients. So, you know, chances are, if you're shopping, you're buying it. And that takes us to something that Whole Foods Market did this year. In March, they announced that by 2018, all products in their U.S. and Canadian stores must be labeled to indicate whether they contain GMOs. Well, if they start doing that and it proves successful, doesn't that sort of pave the way for other markets to do that? Anybody?
So I think that it does, but I think there's a really important distinction that we need to draw, and which is that voluntary labeling or the ability for companies to put a GMO label on their food, that exists now, and hardly anyone participates in that voluntary labeling scheme. And maybe we'll see over long periods of time that private companies or brands are interested in creating that label to access a new consumer market. But at Food and Water Watch, we really think that this needs to be regulated.
So you're saying that the people who shop at Whole Foods are likely to be interested in this, but it's not going to have a general effect.
I wouldn't say that. I don't think that I have the kind of information to make that prediction. But what I would say is this. We have things like the non-GMO project, where companies can pay to get certified as non-GMO and have this label. But very, very few products, a very small percentage of products do this. And it's a part of that is because it costs money. And to me, you know, right now, if we wanted to avoid GMOs, we could buy all organic all the time. But I personally, even I've got a great job, and I don't think that I could afford to go all organic all the time. And for me,
you could grow your own, which is what we advocate on this show.
This is true.
Grow as much of your own as possible.
This is a justice issue. If we want everybody, regardless of their economic status, to have access to what they can confidently know is a non-GMO product, what we need is a bill that means that all foods are regulated and not just foods at what I might consider to be specialty food grocers.
I need to take a short break. Jessica Fuyen is in the studio with the Food and Water Watch. Brian Endress, associate professor from University of Illinois. He's in agricultural law. Megan Klein from the Chicago Food Policy Advisory Council. Hang on, all of you. We will get back. And, of course, your phone calls are welcome at 773-763-9278. 773-763-9278. I'm sure there's a person or two who's interested in this subject, and I hope on a Sunday morning when it's drizzling, you might call in and let us know what you think. Now, at the end of the show today, you're going to hear from my friend and bonsai artist, Dan Costa. He might be interested in an article in the September-October issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. It's a story about Ron Kruger of suburban Berwyn, who has nearly 100 trees in his backyard. But here's the twist. Most of them are under 3 feet tall. Ron created a bonsai forest in his yard, and unlike many bonsai plants, these are deciduous, which means they lose their leaves in the fall. There's also a story in that same magazine about the fungus among us. That is to say, the mushrooms, puffballs, bracket fungi, stinkhorns, wonderful name for a fungus. And then, of course, there's dog vomit fungus, which is one of my all-time, which is actually a slime mold. It's not actually a fungus, but people call it that. And I love it just because it gives me a chance to say dog vomit fungus on the radio. So there you go. Anyway, getting back to the fungus story and other macro fungi that unexpectedly appear in your garden, that story is accompanied by a top 10 need-to-know list about fungi. Like number one, most fungi are not toxic to the touch. So stop, you know, you have to ingest them for them to do their damage. Don't worry, it's just a mushroom. Here's number three. You can't pull them out by their roots. They don't have roots. See, everybody needs to know that. Then there's my column on the inside back page. It's kind of like a fungus in that it's fascinating in a kind of not too appealing way. Get a subscription to Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. Go to chicagolandgardening.com or call 888-265-3600. 888-265-3600.
Looking for a housing investment that can pay big dividends? Remodel your kitchen or bathroom. You'll freshen up your home and add value to it, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling needs. Kitchens, bathrooms, master suites, and more. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Wondering what to do today on a kind of drizzly late summer day? I got an idea. Stop by Bertolt's Garden Center in Elk Grove Village for the final day of their fall open house. Pumpkins, corn stalks, Indian corn, straw, scarecrows, and a great selection of fall decor are waiting for you. Or how about mums, pansies, fall accent plants, and beautiful mixed planters, all reasonably priced? Check out their monster mums planted in bushel baskets. And lots more in the store are on sale. And if you get there before 1 o'clock today, 1 p.m., you'll be in time to see Dr. Wally Schmidtke himself present his Put Your Veggie Gardens to Sleep seminar based on an organic approach on winterizing your gardens. He will address problems you may have encountered through the growing year, followed by a Q&A session. That's today. Yes, today at Bertolt's Fall Open House. Bertolt's Garden Center is located at 434 East Devon Avenue in Elk Grove Village, just west of the O'Hare Airport. Look for the iconic windmill out front or go to bertoltsgardencenter.com. It's the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM this morning. Just to get you going on a Sunday morning, we're talking GMOs. And I have a couple of guests in the studio, and they are Jessica Fuyen, who is with Food and Water Watch, and Brian Endress, who's Associate Professor of Agricultural Law at the University of Illinois. And on the phone, I have Megan Klein, who's a lawyer on the Chicago Food Policy Advisory Council. And we also have a phone call, so let's go to line two and bring in Bill. Bill, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Hey, Mike. Great show as always. And yeah, you did get me fired up with this one. It seems like we're losing the messaging battle, and I know some of that has to do with the money, as your guest indicated a few moments ago. And I think a big part of that is we're not addressing the fact that are properly addressing the fact that if these companies, which I see on Fox News all the time and all these right-wing shows, are always applauding the free market system, really don't believe in the free market system, because if they did, they would allow us the information to make informed choices. That's the free market. I guess my question is, what is being done to counter that really harsh but pervasive messaging from the right wing and from these corporations who are making huge profits on this? So really, a couple of pennies to label thousands and thousands of labels really is not going to affect their bottom line. These guys spend more on lunch than they would spend on ink and labeling for marking these products.
You know, your point is really a good one. It's an excellent one, Bill, and you're right that we have an illusion of a free market. There's really no such thing.
It's free for them. It's not free for us. It's free for them.
And it's manipulated within an inch of its life. And then, the folks, they come on and say, hey, let the market do its thing. And then, of course, when you try to let the market do its thing, which is let's label it, oh, no, you'll kill our business.
Precisely. And in this marketing world, it seems like messaging is everything. And I'm just really curious, what the strategy is to get ahead of that messaging, which I think, if we really have that strong messaging and can get in front of their arguments, there's some legal heavyweights there among your guests.
I think he means you, Brian.
Like we're a court of law and get ahead of that. And I think that helps offset the difference in funds that we can bring to bear to get the word out.
That's a really
the amount of money they can.
Yeah, really great point, Bill. And Brian, I'm going to anticipate what you would say is you'd say, I'm not the messaging guy. I'm the legal analyst here.
Yeah, but I also am a consumer, too. And
okay.
And that's important to think about is that and the one thing that can do this is the consumers, being educated about this topic and demanding some sort of change. And that's what's going to drive change in the food system.
And Jessica?
Yeah, I could also say, Bill, I believe your name is Bill, thanks for your great comment. And yeah. I think what's important to know is not that we have to be, well, first of all, we've got responses to everything the industry has to throw at us. And mm-hmm. when you say, how are we going to respond to this in terms of messaging, what you're really saying is, how is our voice going to be heard in the media? Because it's not that we don't respond to these comments, it's that we need more publicity and we need to be heard in the media. And so obviously we do all we can on that front. But much like large corporations have influence in the legislature, they always have a great deal of influence in the media. And so one of the ways, kind of in the way that we can make or assert our power as consumers, we can make informed choices, like Brian was saying. Mm-hmm. As individuals, we can write to the media. I think that if there are people listening right now who have not done so already, it's important that we send letters to the editor, op-eds to the media, and make sure the media knows that there is, you know, a parallel or a counter argument to a lot of the messaging that the biotech industry has the money to promote, you know, on Fox News or by buying a commercial slot.
Yeah, and if I could put in a shameless plug, Revolution in Beer will be doing several pieces about this, highlighting the profit issue, but trying to get ahead of those messages, and we would, you know, we'll be doing that in support of what you guys are doing this week. So thank you so much, and people can get that article at revolutionandbeer.com this week.
Yeah, W.C. Turk.
Yes,
welcome to the program.
Thank you, buddy.
And I'm glad you're listening, and I'm glad you're concerned
always
with this. And give yourself a plug one more time at Revolution and
revolutionandbeer.com. We'll be hitting the GMO issue and trying to get ahead of some of that messaging. And the one thing that we would encourage, because it's what we do, is folks get out there and occupy the media. Take this message to your neighbors, to your friends, to Facebook, to the internet, and proliferate it everywhere. And that's how we offset that a little bit. But I want to applaud your guests for their great work. Thank you for that. And thank you, as always, Mike, for your great work. So,
all right.
Best of luck, guys. Good night.
Appreciate it, Bill. Talk to you later. And he makes a really good point. About the media in covering these issues, and perhaps it's my own fault, but I missed it when the bill was first proposed, and I just found out about it the other week that this was coming up. Sarah Batka helped me, who's in studio today, and by the way, so is Carol Brewer. Thank you both for being here. I was a little surprised, but I'm not anymore, because I cover issues on this show. And often for my research, I will go online and see what the coverage has been, and often nothing, you know. And I start with the two biggies. I start with the biggies, the Chicago media, generally Sun-Times and Trib, if it's a local issue or a regional issue. I see what they've had, and often it's crickets chirping, and so I have to go farther afield, and that is part of the problem. A lot of these things slip through the cracks, and I think partly it is the control of the media, but I also think it's partly that a lot of the media have no money anymore. They don't have the resources. The reporters that were there covering some of these things, I mean, City Hall beat doesn't get covered the way it should anymore. I think it's being taken over. That job has to be done now by our bloggers and the people online. That's sort of the way these things are going. You don't find them as much in the mainstream, simply because they don't have the resources to do it. And other issues. I mean, it's a complex problem. You're shaking your head like you don't believe me, Jessica.
No, I'm not shaking my head like I don't believe you. I definitely think that one of the ways that we can break into the media is by having more people submit writing about these issues. I think that we're not definitely responsible for doing their job for them, but by creating the kind of buzz that the media covers, we will get more coverage. And I also think that that it's definitely up to some of these publications' editorial boards to take the issue seriously or not.
Okay, let's take another phone call quickly. Let us go to Todd. Todd, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Thank you. Hey, I don't disagree with the labeling. I'm okay with it. But aren't you being just a little disingenuous by not mentioning the fact that the campaign's out there for Frankengenes? I don't see how you're going to feed the world through organic or not manipulating genes, whether it be in the lab or in the field. And I'm a farmer, and I think you'd be better off concentrating on patents on food rather than its labeling.
Okay, that's a really good point, Todd. Anybody care to address that here?
If you don't mind, the one thing is that this is just trying to inform consumers. It's not excluding GM from the market. It's just if you're going to put it in the market, it needs to be labeled. And if there's a price differential, maybe it's less expensive, maybe it's more expensive, you know, that'll sort itself out. With respect to the patents, you know, that's a bigger system that we have. And the Supreme Court actually dealt with it this past year on the patentability of biotech seeds. And unfortunately, for a lot of farmers, the Supreme Court upheld the intellectual property rights for the Monsantos and DuPonts of the world. So taking on that at the state level is not a solution because that's a federal patent law.
Mm-hmm.
So
good point.
And I would also like to add, we thank Todd so much for the work he does as a farmer and all farmers for doing the work that they do to feed the world. But we have to underscore that biotechnology is not a solution to global hunger, that we are currently producing 2,800 calories per day per person, and that hunger is not an issue of how much corn or genetically modified soy we can produce. It's a problem of access. I mean, a lot of that food goes to feed our livestock. And I also wanted to kind of underscore that in 2009, the International Assessment of Agriculture Knowledge and Science, and I'm sorry, and Technology, which was put forth by about 400 scientists, sponsored by the UN, sponsored by the World Bank, they concluded that biotech was not a solution to global hunger problems, and that biotechnology has actually done quite a bit to undermine local markets in developing countries. So what we see is that biotechnology is certainly not a solution to world hunger. However, farmers responding to market demand for transparent food products, I mean, we know that farmers are going to be able to feed the world, and that consumers will be happy to help them do that when we've got the kind of labeling we need.
You know, and we haven't even brought up the issues. There are side issues with this, and this is about labeling. But other things that we have to take into consideration is the creation of super weeds by GMO products, which is that's not part of this issue, but it is there. It is out there. And I wrote about it. And I hope folks will go to my website, MikeNovak.net, go to this week's show. I've got a lot of links there, a lot of information, including the information about the public hearing that's happening. And I want to remind people that it's happening this Tuesday, 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 a.m., the Blandick Building, 160 North LaSalle Room, Room C600. You can sign up to be part of the audience. I have a link on my website that takes you to Food and Water Watch where they can sign you up. Let's take one more quick question before we wrap this up. And, Bob, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, it's just in regards to GMOs, not all GMOs are done by mad scientists in a laboratory. If you look at corn, for example, that was genetically modified by the Aztec Indians over 5,000 years ago. Corn, as we know it today, was a weed. I mean, it was just a little, it was a wild plant that had flower and it produced no fruit. We have the safest food production in the world that we've ever seen on this planet. I mean, they're GMOs. Everybody says GMO, genetically modified. They think it's a really bad thing. I mean, it's protecting plants from insects. It's protecting plants from fungi. It's not all that bad. I mean, and then adding additional layers of legislation for labeling and things like that are only going to drive the cost up, not only for people in the United States that can probably afford it, but in third world countries that can't. So, I mean, like I said, I mean, which GMOs are good and which ones are bad? I mean, obviously, corn was a genetically modified plant, and that was done 5,000 years ago before there were laboratories and microscopes and things of that nature.
That's a good point, Bob. And we're going to address that right now. And the first thing I would say is that we have modified food throughout the history of growing things, but we're at a point where we can put pig genes into corn and not just corn genes into corn. And that's the difference, is that we can take genes from other species and other genuses and put them in a way that we never did. When you did this, develop this over the millennia, you were putting corn and those grasses next to each other, and then working with nature to do this. It's almost as if we're doing this despite nature in some ways. But that would be my argument. But I did want to take it to Megan to talk about some of, you know, he's talking about prices and availability in the city. I suspect that you would have some issue with that working in Chicago.
Well, I do, and I want to raise one issue that we haven't spoken about yet, and that is the difference between genetically modified corn 5,000 years ago and today. Today, corn is genetically modified specifically to be able to withstand herbicides, which are incredibly toxic, and people are concerned about. People may understand herbicides and the toxicity of those, but they may not understand genetically modified foods. And so, while genetically modified foods themselves have not been tested, one thing that the public really wants to know is the amount of chemicals that are potentially in their food.
And that's a really good point. That's the other thing. Bob mentioned controlling insects and weeds. And the opposite is happening. We're losing control. We're losing the battle when we create weeds that are resistant to Roundup because they take on the characteristics of the GMO products. When we get plants or when we get insects, we're creating super insects as well. And these are things we need to discuss. But in this case, it's a side issue. The issue is actually labeling. Mm-hmm. And I guess I would say, as we wrap this up, something we've already mentioned on the show, which is, if we're truly a free market, what's the deal? Why wouldn't we be able to do this? Brian, you got any final words on this?
No, I think the key, though, is as in many pieces of legislation, you have to first get the legislators informed on what the issues are, and then the general public has to get behind this, and it's not just a Chicago versus downstate issue. There are people concerned about this issues, you know, where I am, down at the University of Illinois. We care about these things, and I'd just like to see some more transparency in our food supply.
Jessica?
Yeah, I think that before we go, I think it's really important to address what Bob said, which is that hybridization has happened for thousands of years. It's very important mm-hmm. for plants that are going to be locally resistant to weather, insects, and all kinds of challenges, but that SB 1666 takes on what are basically a handful of large corporations, scientists in a lab, creating products that could never occur in nature, patenting them, and putting a lot of farmers in a financial bind. I think Bob, you know, his comments came from the right place. We are concerned that farmers in other countries are struggling, and they're not struggling with food prices because of GE labeling. In fact, many countries currently label GE foods, and people can't afford food. And unfortunately, in India, we have thousands of farmers who commit suicide because of debt cycles that are associated with the cost of seed and the cost of pesticides. So labeling.
Yet one more side effect of working with genetically engineered products.
So this bill is pro-farmer. This bill is pro-hybridization, the way that farmers are able to do it on the farm. And what we want is for these handful of biotech companies to take responsibility and bear the burden of proof for foods that most of society wants labeled.
Jessica Fuyen, Food and Water Watch, Brian Endress, Associate Professor of Agricultural Law, University of Illinois. Thank you so much for being here. And Megan Klein from the Chicago Food Policy Advisory Council, thank you so much for being on the phone. I appreciate your help.
Mike, thank you so much.
All right, take care. I'll just remind people that the hearing is this Tuesday, 10:30 to 12:30. You can be part of it. Go to my website, MikeNovak.net, or go to Food and Water Watch, and you can find information, and we will continue to follow this story. Here's a tip from the Care of Trees. Mother Nature continues to mess with us this late summer, as she loves to do. This year, she started with way too much rain, got most of us convinced that the water issues were more than covered. Rick DeMaio will talk about that in just a second. And now she's decided to withhold the water just to see if we're paying attention. Are you paying attention? If you have trees, the fall is a crucial time of year. Your trees need to be good and hydrated as we head into the winter, when frozen soil means that they can't take up water. Trees must remain hydrated to carry out their metabolic functions. The process of transpiration, the movement of water from the roots up the tree and out of the leaves in the form of water vapor, provides the tree with a continual source of water, and it continues into the fall. To find out more about the water needs for your trees, contact a certified arborist at the Care of Trees. Call 800-508-9466 for a free consultation, or go to thecareoftrees.com. The Care of Trees, a Davey company. Their business is people and their love for trees.
Hi, my name is Peggy, and I don't want you to be left out. Here's what I'm talking about. Each month, more people turn to Natural Awakening Chicago to improve their lives than any other health or wellness magazine. If you're a green, natural health, or wellness business, you should be part of the leading sustainability resource in the country. Natural Awakenings is packed with information that our readers use to find the products and services they need to live happier, healthier lives. Natural Awakenings is available for free each month throughout the city and north and northwest suburbs. We're placed in more than 1,100 area locations, ensuring the right eyes read about your products and services. We're also online at nachicagonorth.com. We're local, we're independent, and our readers will help you grow your business. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
Is pain keeping you from enjoying gardening? Dr. Bonnie Flaster at River North Wellness Center has gentle and effective techniques to get you out of pain and back to doing what you love. Here are two quick tips. First, remember to stretch. Second, use a timer to make sure you take breaks. Come see her at River North Wellness Center and find more tips at rivernorthwellness.com or call 312-642-7545 to make an appointment with Dr. Flaster and get back to feeling good.
This is the Mike Novak Show in Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. And Rick, I'm sorry, we got kind of carried away with the GMO. I think you can understand how interesting a topic that is.
Yeah, that's fine. For a minute, I thought you were doing a Pontiac GTO discussion and hide the fact that it's, you know, the Geico 400 down at Chicagoland Motor Steel. But that's okay. GTO, GMO, I'm fine with it.
No, GMO. Okay.
Yeah, I got it.
Hey, it's raining.
It's raining out.
how long is that going to go on?
Unfortunately, it's going to rain most of the day today, which is obviously going to make people sitting at Soldier Field a little unhappy.
Ooh.
People up at Conway's Farms, where the PGA BMO champ, BMO, BMW championship is occurring. And then also down at the Geico 400, you know, NASCAR is down at Chicagoland Motor Speedway. So a lot of things going on outside, but us gardeners, we love every drop of it.
Oh, my goodness, yes, we have needed this. You should see Sarah shaking her head. Her headset's going to fall off.
Yeah, it's pretty pitiful. I mean, only 0.15 inches so far of fishtail hair. And you can see that in many, many, many areas, the ground is just awfully parched.
Yeah.
And the strange thing about it is, here we've had some of the hottest weather, all summer, occurring basically in the last week of August and, you know, the first couple of weeks of September, and very, very high rates of evaporation because we've had very hot, I shouldn't say just hot temperatures, but very dry conditions, continuing with the bright sunshine. So again, evaporation rates very high across the area. And the good news, Mike, it all changes. Believe it or not, we get back, and it seems like now we're going to go back into somewhat of a wet pattern. Even though we're going to get some rain today and some dry weather, it definitely looks like some weather patterns taking shape over the Midwest beginning probably by the middle of next week.
Wait, so this is not the pattern change right now that's going to happen?
No, I think we are going into a pattern change, yeah.
Okay.
And it's going to come in little steps. The first step is today, and then we'll dry out a little bit. And then it looks like we'll begin to get into a little bit more moisture, a little bit better chance of seeing some rainfall. What happens this time of the year, it's similar to springtime, where you begin to get a lot of moisture beginning to be transformed, not so much west to east, but north to south and south to north. So you get into more of what we call meridional flow. And because the atmosphere temperature contrast begin to become a little bit greater, the chances of widespread rains seem to be getting a little bit, you know, better as you get into that time of the year. Now, when you take the Colorado, the Boulder, Colorado flood event, which was really biblical in portion, in comparison, you take that out of the context. You say, okay, how does something like that happen? Well, first off, you had probably a lot of tropical moisture coming out of the Gulf of Mexico, as well as some remnant tropical lows coming all the way out of the Pacific Ocean. Slow-moving thunderstorms in a very narrow corridor moving over highly varying terrain, and you got 12 to 14 inches of rainfall. The odd thing about it, Mike, is here you had this 1,000-year flood basically occurring blocks from the National Center for Atmospheric Research, where some of the top climate researchers in the world live, work, and play, and it's basically happening right in their backyard. So a lot of discussion on whether or not this was a rogue event or whether or not it's something that's definitely related to climate change and climate variability.
Or something that they caused because they're over there. No, okay.
Yeah, studies have actually showed where a lot of meteorologists live, you tend to have a lot of snowfall because everybody's going out and measuring it. I got more than you.
Tell them not to look up in the sky and keep their mouths open because they'll drown. All right. Apparently,
I guess that's one way.
Turkeys do that too, I guess. Yeah.
I was out there this past summer, and it was amazing. Right along that Boulder Creek, they actually have a lot of flood control systems that, you know, help mitigate floods like this. And believe it or not, there wasn't as much property damage as you would think, but still, a lot of the infrastructure, the roads, and some of the, you know, walkways and bridges were completely washed out. Never seen anything like this before in my life. Ever.
Wow. All right. Well, we got 30 seconds for our forecast.
Yeah, so rain today, temperatures generally in the low to mid-60s. Rain is pretty much out to the west, all the way into Des Moines, Iowa, and up to parts of Wisconsin. And then once we get past the rain today, cloudy, cool tomorrow, temperatures in the 60s and remaining dry Tuesday and Wednesday before more rain probably by the end of the week.
Wow, pattern change, like you said. We're looking forward to it. Gardeners are looking forward to it. So thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next week, Rick.
Have a good night.
All right, bye-bye. Second hour of the show, we've got Michelle Hoffman on, and she's going to talk about her new film documentary called Microcosm. She takes a very, very close look at our oceans, so stick around for that.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, a Davey company. Their business is people and their love for trees. And by Recycled Granite, featuring eco-friendly split stone veneers and handmade products by individuals with disabilities. Go to recycledgranite.com. Here he is again, Mike Novak.
And let's not forget Bertolt's Garden Center, where you can go to their open house. Last day today. Get green. Let's get growing. Welcome back to the second hour of the Mike Novak Show. And we've just exchanged crew here. And we have a Lisa Albrecht sighting as well. Lisa, you're not supposed to be here. You know that today.
I know, but the show's so interesting. I can't sit at home and listen to it. I couldn't sleep, so I thought, well, why be awake at home when I could be awake in my chair?
You're not going to infect us.
No, I'm not contagious. Stuff. I'm just so far past exhaustion that I have the shakes.
Well, that's not good.
No, I've been Thursday and Friday, I got 2 hours of sleep. So I'm shaking. Yeah.
I want to be here because
I want to talk oceans.
That's cool.
And I'm so disappointed I wasn't part of the GMO conversation, because I know you say the listeners are rather sophisticated, and I understand some of the very basics, but I don't really totally understand all the meat. So I'll go back and, because I was driving, I was missing little bits here and there of the show. So
well,
I'll go back and listen.
There will be a podcast, as always. You can go to MikeNovak.net and download podcasts, and you should sign up for them. I know a lot of folks catch the show that way. They can't listen on Sunday, and then they get it from iTunes or wherever, and they do listen. And in this case, I'm going to dedicate one of the podcast segments to that conversation we had in the first hour. It's possible I might do it with this hour, too, which just creates more work for me, of course. Michelle.
We have to keep you on your toes.
But
yeah. So anyway, but before we get to Michelle Hoffman, and sometimes it's Michelle Hoffman Trotter. What are you going with? Come
Michelle
on.
Michelle Hoffman Trotter.
All right. Because I look around and sometimes I see it as one, see it as the other. You know. All right.
It's evolutionary process, Mike. You understand it.
Yeah, I do. I used to be Michael. Now I'm Mike. Okay. I don't know how that happened either. But Carol Brewer is here this morning. Say hi, Carol.
Hi. How's it going?
Mousketeer roll call. Good. I didn't do the full Mousketeer roll call, but Sarah Batka?
I'm here.
She's slow, but she's here.
And I do have to say hi to my neighbor, Frank. He asked me to give
really?
Him a shout out
A little
today.
Shout out?
Yep.
Okay. Lisa, do you want to do a shout out?
No.
No? How about to
Good
your,
morning.
How about to your pillow?
Yes.
Oh, how I've missed you.
Oh, yes. You got to understand what Lisa's doing. I mean, she says it's all in the service of alternative energy.
Yes, it's all really good stuff. The state of Illinois announced a rebate program. They are hosting a lottery this year, which is something they have not done before. So folks have until October 31st to get their applications in. But I have a lot of folks who installed systems last year who are looking for rebate money and new people. And then I've got lots and lots of new homeowners. So it's a good thing. But I'm really tired. Really tired.
Are you going to fall?
No, I'm not going to fall asleep because I want to talk oceans. I don't want to talk about my fatigue. I want to talk oceans. And, I'm so
but
excited
I, but
to
I,
meet
I,
Michelle.
But I wanted to make sure you got that information across because it is important information about
Yes,
the
and
rebates.
We also have grants available for projects that are greater than $100,000. The state also announced a grant program that will be due November 7th. It's a competitive bid process, but you know, if you're a business, a small business, and you are looking, the state will provide up to 25% of your project totals, greater percents for nonprofits, up to 40% for nonprofits. So there's some great funding out there. The problem in Illinois is that the bucket of money is very small, and so the money will be gone, you know, basically, you know, in a day. So once they
Which
make their
announcement. Which is a shame, yeah.
Yeah, so that means that, you know, me and other installers have to, you know, really have our A game out there because our whole year next year depends on what we do in the next 2 weeks.
Which is why you're not getting any sleep.
She's
so sad.
It's all good. And then just, you know, lots of climate stuff going on. And Illinois Solar Energy Association is hosting some great functions. We're going to have a legislative luncheon on October 22nd or 21st. And there's tons and tons going on. We're raffling an electric car. So there's just...
You are?
So, we are.
I would like an electric
Chicago,
car.
Well, I can sell you a ticket for $40.
It's probably worth it.
It's a great opportunity. There's only going to be about 3,000 tickets sold, so great odds at winning an electric car.
I'm in.
All right. Chevy Volt.
I'll take it.
Awesome. All right.
Whichever.
So lots going on. It's all good stuff.
Well,
lots going on.
I just have
to figure out how to sleep.
I know. Well, before you, if you're going to nod off into the microphone.
I'm not because Michelle is here.
Let's talk oceans. Just turn the microphone off before your head hits it. All right. And I want you to post on Facebook all this great stuff, energy stuff.
I will.
I mean,
maybe after
because we just went through it very quickly and what? Sorry,
maybe after the show and a nap.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can multitask.
If you
right
want
now.
A nap on the floor right now,
no, I want to listen to Michelle.
All right.
Oh, we have a guest in the studio.
I know we do. We're going to get to Michelle in a second
it's
here.
It's not the Lisa Albrecht show.
No. It's not the Let Lisa Whine for a While show.
No.
It seems to be
it's not that you're whining. It's that you're getting all this great information about alternative energy in the state of Illinois.
Yes.
And people need to know this. And
yes. And
I want you to put it on Facebook so that our Facebook friends will get it. And for those who missed all of that,
or didn't have a chance to write it down, guess what? There's a podcast. So when the podcast goes up, you can listen to that and get that information if you're able to do that. And those of you who don't have computers, I don't know what to say. except listen carefully and jot stuff down quickly. Before we get to Michelle, I have Wendy sent me information about the Talking Farm third annual Hullabaloo next Saturday, September 21st, at the Howard Street Farm, 3701 Howard Street in Skokie, from 2 to 6 p.m. Music, demonstrations, farm fun. And it's only $5. It's a $5 suggested donation. It's casual, family friendly. There's campfires, marshmallow roasting, games, farm tours, and music is going to be provided by Strictly Jugnuts. That's what it says. And the Old Town School of Folk Music. Curtis Evans of We Fix Bikes in Evanston is going to show people how to fix flat bike tires. How cool is that? I mean, you'd think everybody would know that, but I bet a lot, you know, I bet a lot of folks don't. Ben Harris will be there to demonstrate his cider press. Event is sponsored by First Bank and Trust and Brown, Kaplan and Liss, an accounting firm in Evanston. So congratulations to them. And again, next Saturday, September 21st, 2013, Howard Street Farm, the Hullabaloo, third annual, a celebration of sustainability at 3701 Howard Street in Skokie from 2 to 6 p.m. And I have done my due diligence. Now, let's get to the lovely woman sitting across from me who's been on the show several times. But last time you were here, we were going to talk microcosm, and it didn't really happen because we were talking sustainability with students, which was a really cool thing. I was glad that you were part of that and you brought in those students. That was wonderful.
Well, you know, the next generation, that's what it's all about.
Right.
So I'm happy to get behind that anytime.
And Michelle Hoffman-Trotter is an educator in far too many places. You're like DeMaio. You're like
He's my idol.
Because he goes to all the, he teaches like at six different colleges.
Yes, he does. Like 12 classes at a time or something obscene like that.
I don't know how he finds time to help me out on Sundays, but I'm so grateful because I know so many people love his reports.
And they love him as a teacher. He's a rock star.
Really?
Rick. He's adored.
All right. Tell me a little bit about Rick as a teacher.
Business, but he's got a great personality. You've seen him on the news. I mean, he's entertaining. How can you not like to watch Rick DeMaio? And he knows his stuff.
And
I
he's
mean,
opinionated, too.
Yeah, well, you know, we all are, aren't we?
I would say one of the things that I find refreshing about Rick is that he respects your opinion as well.
Yeah,
and so, I
does.
Mean, how many times on the show has he complimented me and said, well, you know, Lisa, I mean, he is not so ego-driven that everything's about him. He wants to know your thoughts, and he'll ask questions. And I imagine as an instructor, that's a pretty rare thing.
Oh, yeah. When you're genuine, teachers, students can smell it a mile away.
That's awesome.
He's so relatable. He knows what's going on in gardening world, sports.
Right. Yeah.
I think we have a fan club.
Politics.
We have a fan club.
I will be president of it.
I'll arm wrestle you for that job.
You got okay. I'll give it to you then.
Uh-oh, I'm getting out of here before the feats of strength start.
I will be VP, but I will not be treasurer.
Oh no, that's a good job to avoid.
Yeah,
yeah, avoid that job.
No treasurer. No, and I won't be secretary either.
And if it weren't for Rick, I wouldn't be here because he was a common connection. He was our common denominator.
Right. He brought you into the studio first 4 years ago. In fact, it was one of the rare Rick DeMaio appearances in studio. I think he's been in the studio all of twice. And I think that was once, the first time. And then he came in
this summer.
Yeah. And so how is it you guys met?
We're colleagues at Columbia and School of the Art Institute. So we overlap at least in two places.
Uh-huh.
And now three.
And you're teaching not exactly the same things, but related subjects.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what is it that you teach primarily?
My background is largely in marine science. I have a graduate degree from University of New South Wales in Australia, but I also have a law degree from DePaul University here in Chicago. So I do a lot with sustainability as well.
Law?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
How does one get a degree from New South Wales?
You got to go live in Australia. It's a horrible thing.
It is. It's just terrible.
Absolutely horrible.
Yeah. And you're saying that tongue in cheek, of course.
Of course.
What is it like in Australia?
The people are fabulous. What could possibly be bad? You've got great weather, you've got a gorgeous ocean, and wonderful people to boot.
Did you find yourself saying good day?
I did. I actually ended up talking long in Australian for quite a while.
Or did.
Yeah. She was doing it. Let's hear that.
That's great.
Give us a little Australian.
Should I just do today in the interview? You know, I'll just go with the Australian thing.
I love it. Just people will be faked out. That's great. And from New South Wales, we have Michelle Hoffman Trotter. But now you have been spending a great deal of time putting together. Yeah. And she's nodding because
I'm relating to the no sleep thing.
Yeah. And I get that because if you want to do something important, sometimes you have to forego a little bit of sleep.
Absolutely.
A little bit of shut eye. And it's a documentary called Microcosm, which really doesn't tell the whole story. It I like it because it's succinct, but Microcosm is not just it's the ocean microcosm is the story you're telling. What was the genesis of this project?
You know, it's a lot of things, and I'm thrilled that I'm here today talking with you on a day that you chose to speak about food, because what we're talking about here is the topsoil of the ocean. And without it, we don't have ocean food production, which feeds billions of people around the world. So,
can I stop you right there?
Absolutely.
Topsoil of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
I like that phrase.
Thank you.
Because it is a kind of soil, is it? Is it not?
It is, without a doubt.
And how deep are we talking here? And what, I mean, is it right at the surface or is it a little below? Or what's the topsoil of the ocean?
It is throughout the entire range of the ocean. And just this past week, I don't know if you got to see it, but Antarctica, a new discovery, organisms that have been living in colonies buried beneath ice for 100,000 years that are completely unknown. And here's another piece of a microcosm. And that's a part of the puzzle that tells us where life started on this planet or arrived. Mm-hmm. Which is another theory.
And that's the other thing I've been reading about is Mars and how we suspect that life might have arrived on Earth via Mars.
It is quite
because
possible.
Mars was actually in better shape to support life, 4 billion years ago than the Earth was. Earth
Absolutely.
Was, you know, it. I was listening to this report on it and the idea, you know, for at that time, we might have been all water. And it would have been hard for, it seems odd, but it would have been harder for life to get started, get the building blocks and the amino acids together in this milieu. But on Mars, the situation may have been perfect.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting, too, because another place that we look for the origins of life on this planet, we can turn our attention to the deep ocean vents. So when you ask me where do we find the microcosm, we find it everywhere. And Janet Voigt from the Field Museum was kind enough to interview with us and talk about her work on the deep ocean vents and how, you know, this only, for old people like me, right, the 1970s wasn't that long ago. And that's when we first discovered that there are these organisms, these chemosynthetic organisms. And that changed the way that science viewed life on any planet for that matter, because you've got organisms that are not photosynthetic. You've got organisms that are chemosynthetic, which means that they're living in the deep freeze of the ocean floor. They're also tolerating temperatures of 600 degrees Fahrenheit at these vents. And they're not utilizing the sun because they live in a completely sunless, darkened environment. So it's a game changer. It changes the way that we view everything on the planet.
So this is all part of your microcosm.
Yes. My microcosm. It's mine. This is all part of the conversation in this film.
Oh, my goodness. So tell me, you talk about the building blocks, and there are these organisms there. One of the things you mentioned on your website, and you can go to the website, which I have a link to at MikeNovak.net. Go to this week's show, and you'll see in bold there, Microcosm. But if you want to go straight there, it's microcosmfilm.com. And the point you make is that a lot of these very small creatures, critters, whatever you want to call them.
I call them micro beasties or living snowflakes.
because no two are alike?
They're fabulous. Their form is gorgeous. I mean, they do look like living snowflakes. And
so tell me, what are some of these microbeasties?
You know, there are some that stay microbeasties their whole life cycle, and then there are others that form things like coral reefs. We don't think of coral as a microorganism because in some cases it's so large we see it from outer space, but for a significant amount of time, whether it's days or a couple of weeks, they live their life as microplankton, and then they form these unbelievable reefs.
So you have all these different creatures there, and some of them, you know, can result in these huge, huge systems, which is coral reef. But we're also at a point where we're messing with our. So it's not just a study of, oh, look, aren't these wonderful? It's now, oh, look, these are wonderful, and we're messing with them. We're going to kill them. And we know that our coral reefs are disappearing. And we know that the oceans are acidifying. What kind of consequences are we looking at?
You know, this past year was an interesting year. It was a tragic year, especially for the Florida manatee population, which is already a small population and a population that we're working so hard to protect. But this year, there were some really horrible algal blooms that are toxic. And so we saw 10% of the Florida manatee population take a downturn this year. Yeah. You know, and I think the thing that gets overlooked a lot is that we're also talking about organisms that provide over half of our planetary oxygen production. So it's not just about cute, cuddly manatees. This is about us, too. And even though we're here in Chicago in a landlocked region, we cannot overlook the fact that we are directly connected, consequentially connected to what's happening in the ocean. It's not just the beauty of the coral reefs. It's you and me sitting here right now.
And how do we affect that? I mean, you say we're directly connected to it. Somebody sitting in Chicago says, well, I can pick up garbage on Lake Michigan, you know, go to one of those beach cleanups, which is great. In fact, there's one coming up. But how else? How does one? Yeah, all right. For example, I had Steve Wilson from Five Gyres Institute on the show several weeks ago talking about microbeads in our Great Lakes. And they just did a study of Lake Michigan. The results aren't even out yet, and they will be any week. And as soon as they are, I'm going to announce them on the show. But it's going to show basically that it's like Lake Erie that they found out last year has these ridiculous numbers of microbeads floating around in there, as do the oceans. So how do the oceans affect your microbeasties?
Well, you know, you mentioned ocean acidification, and that is one example. And that also goes back to our greenhouse gases, the carbon dioxide that's going into the ocean. And that is directly what's causing it. So, you know, I want to revert back to what you just said about alternate energies and, you know, really making sure that our voices are heard when it pertains to pushing for these alternate energies. And one of the phenomenal interviews that I got to do in Canada is with a young man who hasn't even hit 30 yet, God bless him. And he is cutting edge, leading the work towards biofuels that are particularly aimed at the aviation industry. And these are algae-based biofuels. And the beauty of the algae is that it takes up much less growing space and requires much less in the way of greenhouse gases for production purposes. And so we're not losing jobs. We're creating new jobs and new jobs that are going to create a cleaner future. The potential of what this man is doing is incredible, absolutely incredible.
It is really exciting to see the research into algae fuels. Yes.
It is. And replacement of petrol components in plastic as well.
All right. I'm going to ask you kind of a dumb question, but I'm good at that. The algae, is it taking advantage of algae, rampant algae blooms, or do you have to create algae in the lab to do this?
That's an excellent question. And they do it in the lab. And, you know, it's basically all intellectual property. So, you know, Mather, my interview subject, couldn't even really say too much about the proprietary information. But it's a matter of extrapolating the oils from the algae. And so it has tremendous promise. Thomas, and his whole goal in targeting the aviation industry is that both the United States and Canada have committed a certain percentage of their military fuel usage, specifically aimed at aviation, to committing to biofuels going forward by 2025. So it's not only a smart business move, but it's a smart environmental move.
So
I believe that there also is some research on taking the algae from our wastewater treatment mm-hmm. plants and things like that. So I think it's still in its infancy.
That the
research needs to happen first, and then the sourcing of the algae, which will in turn make the fuels, will come from there. But I think it has so much promise. Especially, I love the idea because one of the biggest issues at a wastewater treatment plant is the algae byproduct, and so turning that into, you know, is no different than a farmer turning everything into a resource. So what one problem creates a new solution.
So how do these biofuels compare, say, to the switchgrasses we grow out on the plains?
Well, of course, you know, when you're talking to the people who are creating them, they would argue that they're much better, that they're much more efficient, that you can get more bang for your buck per square foot, you know, of growing space and that sort of mm-hmm. thing. So they would argue that it's even more efficient.
And I've spoken to some folks that I've seen a chart from Argonne that shows, you know, the part of the issue is the density of the fuel properties. Mm-hmm. And that's why petroleum is so amazing, because it's such a dense fuel property. But one of the advantages, I think, if I understand it correctly, of algae is that it's a very fatty substance. And so they're able to turn that fat into something else, whereas some of the biofuels are a lot more leaner. And that is the extent of my knowledge of biofuels.
And I'm going to add to that, because you're completely correct. And I'm going to add to that because one of the issues, especially in the aviation industry, is the intense temperature differentials, right. You know, how the fuel flows in an extremely cold environment is one of the interesting challenges. But from what I understand, we may be able to overcome some of that with this type of technology.
But that still doesn't address the algae blooms that we have now.
No, it doesn't,
because you're creating this in the lab, as you
right.
said. But how do we address these other issues with the oceans we have and Great Lakes? And
yeah.
other lakes and streams.
It's the organisms, too. It's the organisms that we're talking about, because, you know, there's a certain type of organisms that are causing these issues that you're, you know, raising. The algae blooms, the red tides, the brown tides, those are specific types of organisms. And not every organism is necessarily equally adapted to create the types of biofuels that we're talking about. So we have to almost treat them as separate problems. And one of the biggest things that's leading to the red tide and brown tide episodes, of course, is agriculture and the runoff from agriculture. And so, you know, until we can kind of get our heads around how we're going to deal with those runoff problems, mm-hmm. Because, you know, you put fertilizer on your plants to grow them, that stuff runs off somewhere, and that fertilizer works equally well in the water column as it does, you know, on land. And so that's what perpetuates what we want to call maybe explosive growth. I won't say excessive, right. we'll say explosive right. Growth of algae populations.
And which is why when I talk to folks and I talk to garden clubs and they ask me about fertilizers, I say, you know, what do you think happens when you buy a bag of lawn fertilizer and the first number on it is 28? Okay, 28% by volume nitrogen is in this bag. Now, do you really think that those grass plants are going to suck up every bit of that nitrogen so it doesn't go into our water? And when you double the amount because you think it'll work better uh-huh. on your lawn and your lawn will be greener, what do you think you're really doing? And that's the issue. And so what happens then is that Michelle Hoffman Trotter is left to pick up the pieces. Okay. She's got to dive into the ocean and swim around and look at these little, micro beasties. I love that term. Micro beasties that have been engorged with nitrogen.
And they're making tons of babies, and it creates a big problem.
Isn't that amazing?
It is. Everything's a chain reaction.
Yeah. So
see how the circle of life, you know, feeds off one another. Nothing is in isolation. That's
well,
what goes back
no
to
away.
The GMO stuff,
there
too.
There is no away.
Right.
We have this perception of throwing things away. It's my favorite oxymoron, because there is no away. Earth mm-hmm. is a closed system.
There's no. Yeah. There used to be. We used to think
that
there was a way.
There's illusion.
And you're saying something that I have started saying in the last few years, which is there's no such thing as a way. Okay, remember that. Remember that as you're in your kitchen right now, and you're putting something in what you call the garbage. And whether it's a piece of plastic or styrofoam or food scraps or whatever, it's or metal or electronics, and say, oh, well, I'm done with it. I'm throwing it away. No such thing. Yeah. Away does not exist. Okay. It's going someplace and you just made it go someplace. All right. Are you ready to be responsible for that? And you'll end up like Lisa, not getting any sleep. if you do think about that. Well, no, seriously, yeah. Because that's what's happened in our house. In our household is that anytime we throw something away, we think, can I recycle this? Can I compost it? Should I try to reuse it? Can I take it someplace? Because ultimately, where does it end up? The ocean, right?
It does. And the beauty of it is we've got these young people and my own son, who I promised I'd say hi, Ryan Patrick Trotter.
Hi, Ryan Patrick Trotter. Good morning.
I just put him on scuba for the first time.
And I broke the bell.
You did?
I did.
Really? How old is he?
I actually put him on scuba at 5.
Yeah.
Got him started because he was like ready and raring to go from the minute he came to the surf.
So you can do that with parental.
I'm a scuba instructor, so okay. Anybody who out there who works for scuba shops, this never happened. But the world that you open up to a child when you get them involved with these things and get them thinking about these things, and that's really where I come from as an educator, is to help people understand something and to make it relevant to them. Because I teach science at schools that are let's be honest, they're art schools, and a lot of them come to my classroom. Okay, I got to suck up a science credit. This seems like the least frightening science class I can take. And the bottom line is it does matter. We all do science every day. We all use analytical thought. And if I can make something relatable, if I can make a concept like this, like what you just described, Mike, relatable to people, then it's a starting point and it's an important starting point. Education is a big piece of it.
That is Michelle Hoffman Trotter. You consider yourself the director?
I am the director. I'm the director, the producer, and right now the coffee girl.
A little bit of everything.
Much like you, Mike.
of the documentary Microcosm coming to a screen near you. How far along in the process are you?
We are just getting started on this road. I'm hoping, very, very hopefully hoping, that early 2016 will be the completion date and release.
Okay. I've got photos on my website. I have a link to the Kickstarter you did.
We did. We were successful, which is how we got to Canada to film this summer. So that was fantastic.
And you talked to some pretty amazing people, obviously.
Incredible people.
So the you're splitting the time between... Oh, did you fix it? She's up. That's why Lisa's here, so she can fix the bell. I was going to give it to your son.
Ryan Trotter, get a shout out.
There we go. And... have the interview part of the film, but you also have the photography, and you've spent a lot of time in front of a microscope. And did you get what kind of equipment did you find to shoot through a microscope?
You know, Columbia College has been so good to me. It was where I got my undergraduate degree. It's the first teaching job I ever got, and they've been kind enough to set up a lab for us and supply me even with some extra hands and some help. And so we've been using actually a few different types of microscopes and picking up the high def footage with pretty much a jury-rigged Nikon D7000 to get the high def video footage that we've been lifting from the microscope. So,
oh, that old thing, that old warhorse.
It takes four scientists to figure out, though, how to attach it to a microscope.
Ah.
That's the hard part.
You know what you use?
You know, it's just an extension tube that the company itself created.
Oh,
so
no,
it's a special.
Gaffer's tape.
Oh, there you go. That works too.
That's what
I guess.
You need. Duct tape. That'll
okay,
work.
Fair enough. We'll try that next time.
Okay. Duct tape will solve everything. What? You're going to explain to me how to attach this lens to a...
No,
just ask Ron Cowgill. I'm sure.
Let's get Cowgill in here. Yeah, he'll do it. And he would say duct tape.
Duct tape.
And Shedd Aquarium's been nice enough to give us some creatures to look at under the microscope. One of my favorites so far was a miniature jelly from their jellies exhibit.
Oh, really?
It was a moon jelly, but it was tiny. I mean, you couldn't really even see it in the jar of water. It was so small. And now we've got it under the microscope, and you can see its mouth moving, and it's undulating, and it's doing all this really cool stuff.
Now, will it grow to something visible, or
oh,
is
yeah.
it always
they get
stage?
To be okay. about the size, I guess, I want to say, of a softball
okay.
or so.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they get
they
to be
start
big.
That tiny. Wow.
So
Wait,
many
things.
babies do.
And if you give them nitrogen, they get to be the size of a house.
They eat your house.
They
what
eat
happens.
Your house, right. Just consume
I think
it.
I saw a movie about that in the 60s, right?
They're running rampant in Colorado right now. All right, we need to break here for a second. Again, we're talking to Michelle Hoffman Trotter about microcosm, this is great stuff. It's just really cool. And when we get back, we'll talk just a little bit more about it. But first, and before we do that, I had talked about Adopt a Beach, so I went online to find out went to Alliance for the Great Lakes, and you can go to greatlakes.org/SAAB, which stands for September Adopt a Beach. It's next Saturday, 21st, 9 to noon. Dates may vary. There's a Minnesota event, September 28th. But if you just go to greatlakes.org, and you can get involved in a cleanup. Individuals, families, schools, communities, scouting, religious groups, you go along the shoreline and help make our Great Lakes a better place. And I'm glad that we talked about it and I got a chance to mention that. D. Landreth Seed Company wants you to remember that now is the time to plant elephant garlic. Excuse me. Actually, I hurt myself. The elephants will remember for you. However, elephants remember that elephant garlic is not a garlic. It is a member of the leek family. But its cloves have a flavor and fragrance similar to mild garlic. Elephant garlic produces a giant garlic-like bulb, which usually contains 3 to 4 cloves per bulb. The cloves can be as large as small plums. I wonder if you knew that. Elephant garlic takes a long time to mature, at least 8 months, and in harsher climates, 10 to 12 months. This plant can tolerate a broad range of climates from zone 4 to zone 9. People who have forgotten to harvest all of their elephant garlic report that some have remained in the ground for as long as 3 years with no ill effects. I kind of like that kind of a plant. When harvesting, leave the stalk attached, as with garlic, but only for 2 or 3 weeks. Remove the stalks and store the bulbs in a cool, dry, dark area. The bulbs, when baked, are exquisitely delicious and incredibly dangerous, gastrointestinally speaking. Find out more, and find out what they really mean, by going to LandrethSeeds.com or go to their Facebook page, Landreth Seed Co., LANDRETH, or call 800-654-2407. D. Landreth Seed Company, purveyor of fine seeds since 1784.
Trying to weather the housing market? Consider replacing your windows and siding. Remodeling Magazine says they're some of the nation's most popular projects today.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling and energy needs. Rated A+ by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
It's Dr. Wally's Tip of the Week, brought to you by Bertolt's Garden Center in Elk Grove Village. Wally isn't a real doctor. He isn't even on Wikipedia. Dr. Wally calls this to feed or not to feed. Now is the time to stop fertilizing evergreens, roses, summer flowering perennials, hydrangeas, and azaleas. Fertilizers, especially slow-release types, will continue to release nutrients that might cause new, tender growth that can be damaged by cold weather. Deciduous trees, we talked about them earlier, trees that drop leaves in the fall, can benefit from an application of fertilizer till the ground is frozen. Trees will store supplies for spring, plus some of the fertilizer will be taken up when the soil warms up in the spring. You know, and here's a tip to remember if you're going to be applying, because we were talking about the runoff from fertilizer and how dangerous that is. Don't do it before a storm, ever. It just ends up in the sewers, and then it ends up in you know where.
You know what's so funny, though? I think a lot of people, well, I have seen in the past anyway, when I lived in the suburbs and saw people doing their yards, that they'd kind of get out there and frantically do yard work before the storm.
Well, if it's going to be a gentle rain, that's a different story.
Uh-huh.
But if you know you're going to get a lot of rain in a short time, no, it's the worst. And it's hard to judge. Yeah, it's hard to know if that's the case. Anyway, lawns especially benefit from a fall feeding. Don't use too much fertilizer, as we mentioned before. Add a couple of inches of organic material to your veggie gardens and your lawn and let it break down over the winter. And it'll be ready for turning in the spring in your veggie garden. For more information, stop by today, Dr. Wally, at 1 o'clock. He's going to have his seminar. It's at Bertholdt's Garden Center, 434 East Devon Avenue in Elk Grove Village, just west of O'Hare Airport. Look for the iconic windmill out front or go to bertholdtsgardencenter.com.
They paved paradise and put up a parking lot. With a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot.
All together now.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? It'd be a paradise, put up a fucking lot.
Everyone's thinking, no. No. He said everyone.
Yeah, everybody.
That was the only words I knew, was put up a fucking lot.
Oh, that's all right. And it kind of makes sense here talking to Michelle Hoffman Trotter, because this is something that you become aware of as you're doing this research. Now, are you? You said you got some shots from Shedd Aquarium, but are you also going out to the oceans to do this?
Absolutely. And this past summer, we spent time in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, and we interviewed people. We spent some time in the ocean. And one of the most interesting things that we filmed when we were there was Bay of Fundy, because it's the biggest tidal exchange in the world. And so we have this phenomenal time-lapse sequence that shows just how dramatic this water movement really is, because that's what moves these microorganisms and distributes them throughout the world. So if we don't understand how the water moves, we don't understand where to find these populations of organisms. And so we spent some time examining that tidal exchange, figuring out how to film it, how to work with it, and then also looking at the whales, which, of course, are supported by the microfauna. So we spent some time looking at the macro feeding on the micro.
Ah. And the Bay of Fundy is a cool thing.
It's phenomenal.
Why is it the tidal exchange so great there? Some place has to be the largest one in the world.
Exactly. And, of course, tides are driven by the gravitational exchange between the sun, the moon, the earth, and also the way that the earth revolves on its axis around the sun. So it's a very special and unique place. So there are places that experience extreme tidal exchange, but it is the greatest far and away. And we're talking about water movements of upwards of 60, 70 feet. It's truly incredible. And our time-lapse sequence, which you can also see on our website, is it's filmed at Hopewell Rocks, which also happens to be a World Heritage Site. So not only is it just intense to watch the way that the water moves, but there's also these really interesting pinnacles. They call them flower pots, little islands that stick up out of the ocean so that it actually gives the viewer a little bit of perspective. And where you can see people walking out on these mudflats, all of a sudden these kayaks come in, and you can appreciate how profound it all is in the scheme of things. It's really amazing to watch.
Oh my gosh, do you need researchers to go with you?
I always need help. I have such a posse of students across my universities who are engaging in this project, helping us plan our upcoming fall event on October 17th. We have some wonderful young people, sound engineers at Columbia, who are working on the sound for the film. So this is kind of like It Takes a Village to Make a Movie. I've been working with all these young, incredibly talented people who really care. Not just that they're getting their stuff for their resume, but actually are just really ensconced in the subject itself.
I was going to volunteer, but she said she's working with talented people. So.
Stop.
Do you need a narrator?
No. Hey, we're still hiring for voice work, because right now it's my horrible voice you'll hear on the trailer. So we definitely need to make that.
I'm raising my hand here. I'm available to donate my time to do a little bit of narration. I would love to do that.
So
that
let's talk
really
real
cool.
quick. Your fundraiser is when and what?
We are going to have an event on October 17th. Columbia College is sponsoring it for us, which is wonderful. And we decided to make the theme of the evening using art for social change.
Oh.
And so we have some just incredible art that's come to us from the Bahamas, from other parts of the world, artists who've contributed their work in the hopes of helping us raise funds for our initiative. So there will be a silent art auction. We also have some tremendous keynote speakers, one of whom is Shelby Steiner. She's an alum of Columbia College and a rising fashion star. And her big kind of launch collection was based on the film The Cove, which is about the killing of dolphins in Taiji, Japan.
Oh, I've seen that.
Yeah.
Oh, that is a rough movie.
It really is. And so she had this whole line that was inspired by that film. And then we also have Buddy Rivara, who is a graduate of School of the Art Institute. She's a storyteller and a muralist. And her work is influenced by the artist Ernst Haenkel, who was really infatuated also with these microorganisms. And she happens to be deaf. So she literally uses her art as a voice. And so she's going to be speaking. And then myself and my co-producer, Annie Crawley, of Dive Into Your Imagination.
You got to mention Annie, of course.
Of course.
And we've tried to get her on the show.
It'll happen.
It will happen. I got a feeling sometime before the end of this project, she will be here because Michelle says, oh, you have to have Annie on the show. And
she's
terrific. And it just hasn't worked out yet. Yeah.
She
and who is she?
Her company is Dive Into Your Imagination. She's based in Seattle. And the whole focus of her company is educating the future generations about the ocean. Her company thing is the way the new generation views the ocean and themselves. And I've written curriculum with her for classrooms, for teachers, because, you know, it's not even required to teach about the ocean in grammar school levels here. And so that's amazing to me that we can go through what we deem to be an education. And by high school, we have maybe never heard really anything about the ocean. And it covers 2/3 of our planet. So Annie and I have a mission. And Annie is a very gifted videographer. She's already produced several of her own DVDs. She's won awards. So a lot of the macrofauna footage that you'll see, the phenomenal manta rays and the gorgeous whales, a lot of that is her video work. And she's incredibly talented.
Okay. We got to wrap up here, but do you feel as though this film is going in directions you didn't anticipate?
It always does.
I'm sure it hey, my shows do that. Okay, 2 hours every Sunday. I never know where we're going. But so if indeed it is, what has surprised you?
You know, I've always been an optimist. So I think that hearing that people are doing things like I talked about Mather Karskallen and his biofuels and just the innovation that people have that will help us through some of these things. And I don't want this to be the kind of film that somebody watches and wants to slit their wrists. I really want this to be the kind of film that will help people figure out what it is they can do. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you know, I don't want people to be complacent and I don't want people to feel overwhelmed by a problem. I want people to feel that they can actively engage in something that's going to improve things.
In our climate work, we call that the hope budget. Mm-hmm. You have to make sure people's hope budget is still up there because the story is heavy. The information is challenging and knowing that we are responsible is heavy. So yes. I'm excited. I can't wait to see your movie.
Thank
so
you.
Let's remind people, October 17th at Columbia College, 600 South Michigan Avenue, 8th floor. The evening is called Microcosm, an evening of art and inquiry. It's only $20. You can participate. Hey, you can say you were in on the ground
floor. There's a raffle.
That's right.
Of this and
there's
the
raffle.
Yes, there is. Tickets for all of it are on sale now. You can get tickets right off the website if you choose to.
Yeah, and I have the link at mikenovak.net. Go to this week's show.
Space is limited, so buy your tickets ahead of time, I'm telling you.
Expand the space if you need it.
I wish we could.
Yeah. All right, well, Michelle Hoffman-Trotter, thank you so much. It's so
thank
great
you,
to
Mike.
Have you.
You.
And, of course, you're going to be here. Again, as we get to the completion of this documentary.
Got to keep the updates rolling.
I know, and bring Annie in. And she just brings so much life into the room. That's why she's
here. I
know,
I started tired, and wow, I feel giggly. Just sitting next to her.
That's because you're tired.
Oh,
I'm used to have to keeping people awake. I'm a teacher.
Okay, here's a tip from the Care of Trees. Actually, it's a news story that was posted on the Care of Trees Facebook page a while back. Here's a quote. We have underestimated the importance of trees. They are not merely pleasant sources of shade, but a potentially major answer to some of our most pressing environmental problems. We take them for granted, but they are a near miracle. In a bit of natural alchemy called photosynthesis, for example, trees turn one of the seemingly most insubstantial things of all, sunlight, into food.
for insects, wildlife, and people, and use it to create shade, beauty, and wood for fuel, furniture, and homes. For all of that, the unbroken forest that once covered much of the continent is now shot through with holes. Humans have cut down the biggest and best trees and left the runts behind. What does that mean for the genetic fitness of our forests? No one knows for sure, for trees and forests are poorly understood on almost all levels. And I believe that article, isn't that just an amazing quote? And it was from a New York Times article. And, you know, talking about the ocean and how little we understand that, we don't even understand the trees in our backyards and in our forests. Well, the certified arborists at the Care of Trees are going to help you understand your trees. Call 800-508-9466 for a free consultation. You can call them today. They'll get back to you tomorrow. Or go to thecareoftrees.com. The Care of Trees, a Davey company. Their business is people and their love for trees.
Hi, my name is Peggy, and I publish Chicago's only local magazine dedicated to healthy and sustainable living. Natural Awakenings is available monthly, and we provide the latest news and trends about healthful living, including alternative and complementary medicine, fitness, good food and drink, healthy kids and families, and even healthy pets. Natural Awakenings also talks about local sustainability, gardening and environment, energy conservation, and green living. We feature local news and a calendar to help you stay connected. I can guarantee that each month you'll discover a new health tip, a tasty recipe, a service in your neighborhood, something that makes your life better. Natural Awakenings is free and available throughout the city and suburbs or online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good. Live simply. Laugh more.
Allergies acting up, trouble breathing, headaches, sinus pressure, you're tired, congested. Isn't it time to feel better? Breathe deeply and easily. Get rid of the symptoms that complicate your life. Dr. Bonnie Flaster is an acupuncturist and chiropractor who helps people get rid of allergies without using drugs, shots, or needles. Call Dr. Flaster at River North Wellness Center, 312-642-7545, or go to rivernorthwellness.com to find out how to get your body feeling better so you can enjoy life again.
It's the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. We're going into the home stretch here. We're going to have a couple announcements from Lisa in a second, but let's bring in Dan Costa, my buddy, and Mr. Bonsai himself. How are you, buddy?
Pretty good, Mike. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. You've got another one of your great events coming up. If you go to my website and MikeNovak.net and go to this week's show, I kind of quoted you. You made this announcement when you wrote to me. You said, Bonsai is on the ascendancy.
Yes.
Or is that ascendance? I don't know if I used it right now that I'm wondering.
Check Google.
Yeah.
Bonsai interest is definitely on the increase. We're seeing a lot more people getting involved with it, a lot more people asking about it. And so at the show this coming weekend, we're hoping to help a lot of people get into the hobby and get started with some trees and materials and really get to enjoy it.
And I want to tell folks that if they go to my website and if they go to Vern Goer's greenhouse, because that's where Dan works, I didn't realize this until I went there yesterday. I was doing a little research, and on the homepage of Vern Goer's greenhouse, which is VERNGOERS greenhouse.com, you've got the clip from Dig in Chicago that we shot at your place this year.
Yeah, we thought that would be a good thing to have on our website. And yesterday I had all-day bonsai event going on at the greenhouse. We did a class in the morning and then a workshop in the afternoon. So we had some events there as well. leading up to our show.
And, of course, the big show is next Saturday and Sunday, September 21st and 22nd. Prairie State Bonsai Society will be at the Morton Arboretum, 10 to 5, both days.
10 to 4.
Oh, okay. I've got, all right, 10 to 4. Thank you.
10 to 4 both days.
I have to correct that online here. Okay.
Display of trees from the membership. You know, some of my trees will be in there, and several of our other members will be displaying their trees. We're going to have demonstrations going on both days, one in the morning, one in the afternoon each day. I will be doing a demonstration on Saturday. 10 in the morning, I have a demonstration on a ficus. And so that'll be kind of a nice one. We also have three masters coming in. We have Brian Siskowski from Cass Bonsai in Edwardsville, Illinois. Jim Doyle from Nature's Way Nursery in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And Ivan Waters, who is curator of bonsai at the Chicago Botanic Garden. And they will be around. We'll also have six workshops going on. People can sign up for the workshops through the Morton Arboretum website. And, of course, there'll be people around all day talking about bonsai. You can ask questions to our members.
Do you
selling stuff? So.
Do you like pass out medication to keep people from getting OCD about their bonsai?
No, we like them to get involved and get infected.
Obsessed,
with bonsai
obsessed. Yes, that's the and that's why I look at it. Is you guys, Dan, it's taken over your backyard, I think that happens when people start doing this and they snip and they clip and they have these little. plants. And yeah, I got to tell you something. I love this photo that's on the Prairie State Bonsai site. It's prairiestatebonsai.com. The Pyracantha.
Mm-hmm.
It's in bloom.
What a berry.
It's got, yeah, and that's something that I think folks forget, and I forget, is that you can actually get those plants to bloom even though they're miniatures.
And this, that is the tree that won our People's Choice Award last year. Every year we have the people who come into the show can vote on the tree that they think is the best, and then that one goes on our website on the homepage for the next year. And we're also going to be having Ivan Waters judging the show and picking out his what he thinks is the best tree in the show, and then that tree will also get an award. And so we do have a small amount of judging, but in general the show is not judged. But there's so many kinds of trees that can be grown as bonsai, and
yeah.
People need to find out about those.
Yeah,
it's
not just
the junipers.
Right, not just the junipers. It's not just for junipers anymore.
Quite right.
You have a number of different kinds of trees that would just show people. And then they go to a show like this, and then they understand that the possibilities are limitless. You can do almost anything.
And after a while, bonsai kind of just takes over your life like it has with me, and you have to have them around all the time, otherwise you feel lost.
Hence the medication I was talking about. Anyway.
I see on here a maple tree.
Mm-hmm.
There's a maple tree.
Yeah, you can do maples. They make beautiful bonsai.
Yeah. I'm telling you, just about anything. You can do, it doesn't even have to be a tree necessarily. So.
No, a lot of them are actual shrubs.
Yeah.
Yews make wonderful stuff, and cotoneasters are great. Boxwood is a good material. That's what we worked on yesterday at the greenhouse. But anything like a maple or an elm or whatever, they will get their fall color in the fall, just like natural trees. They'll lose their leaves for the winter, just like natural trees, bud out the next spring, all fresh new growth. So you have the same rhythms that you have in nature. And we also have things that are suitable for growing indoors.
Yeah.
Tropical things that you can have in your house.
And that's all next week. Prairie State Bonsai Society show, September 21st, Morton Arboretum, 10 to 4. The information is on my website or go to prairiestatebonsai.com. Dan, have a great show. We will talk again soon, and I'll get you in here, and I'll make you bring some bonsai, and we'll have it going through the speakers and try to, maybe we're going to get video here someday. Who knows?
Yeah, well, I'm always ready to come down to the station and talk about bonsai.
I know you are. All right.
Favorite subject.
Have a great Sunday, and thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Mike.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
This is absolutely the perfect time to plant bulbs for spring blooming, and Christy Weber's Farm and Garden Center wants to make sure that you have the best selection for your urban or suburban garden. Be sure to save a couple of dates. The first is September 19th. From 6 to 8 p.m., that's the Bulb Extravaganza evening event. Learn how easy it is to plant bulbs. You can sip a cocktail, receive 20% off your purchase of spring bulbs. Planting bulbs is as easy as dig, drop, done. Sounds like Mighty House. Christy Weber's has premium Netherland bulbs guaranteed for success. And Christy reminds you that now is the time to purchase perennials. They need 3 to 4 weeks of mild weather in order to become established before winter. Then mark your calendar for Christy Weber's Farm and Garden Center's upcoming Fall Harvest Festival, September 28th and 29th, in just a couple of weekends, with a petting zoo, mini maze, face painting, pansy potting. You can even build your own scarecrow. We'll have him on next week to talk more about this. Follow Christy Weber Landscapes on Facebook or go to ChristyWeber.com to find out more. Christy Weber Landscapes, right in your own backyard. Okay, we've got like a minute and a half here. You wanted to get something in, Lise?
Yes, so I will post this on the Mike Novak website, but lots going on this next weekend if you're not going out to the Morton Arboretum for the bonsai event. The Southeast
Bonsai,
bonsai,
please.
Bonsai.
Bonsai.
I know, I have the American.
Bonsai. No, you were going bonsai. Bonsai. It's bonsai.
Bonsai. So the Southeast Environmental Task Force has their last tour of the season. It is the Industrial Evolution Tour, and that will be from 10 until 2. I will post that. And then if you've not heard, 350.org has teamed up with many environmental organizations to do a nationwide event next Saturday. Go to 350.org, type in your zip code. It is called Draw the Line, Stop Keystone XL, and that will be various locations across the country. There are four just by putting in my zip code. So definitely worth your time next Saturday. Get out, vote with your voice.
All right. Great to have that information. You're going to post that on Facebook, right?
I shall.
All right. And probably Twitter when Sarah stops sneezing. I don't know what's bothering you today, but oh well. End of the show, folks. We say go green or
go home.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.